Well, on 8th January 1980. So you were saying that the situation that you saw in the Soviet Union in 1961 is not unlike what was in the U.S. 10 or 15 years ago.
Yes, we had dozens and dozens of radio astronomy projects, all supported in diverse ways, and of varying merit.
It just was not an efficient use of funds, yeah.
I wouldn't like to argue about the efficiency or not, because if you have a program that doesn't seem to be as good as what is going on at the University of Michigan, is that inefficient? You've got no way of saying what's happening in Florida and how that will feed into other values in the country. There's no one wise enough to say.
No, but of course you can't do everything. You have to make decisions at some point.
Well, it depends who makes the decisions. If they're made locally, if the local Chamber of Commerce will fund a radio astronomy venture in Florida, that sort of decision doesn't arise.
Right, but that wasn't really the case in the U.S. 10 or 15 years ago. It was ONR and NSF, pretty much, wasn't it?
And about six others at least.
Oh, really?
Well, let's start naming them. It was the Carnegie Foundation. Ford Foundation gave out lots of money, including giving money to Australia.
Well, I know that, but did they actually fund anyone in the U.S.?
I suppose so. I wouldn't care to say.
No, that
does the Army Signal Corps.
Who do they fund?
Well, I'm just talking about 10 or 15 years ago.
No, but who did they fund?
Well, they got the first moon echoes.
Oh, but no, that's 46 now.
Yeah.
But they didn't stay in the game.
Yes, they did. You could still apply to the Signal Corps for cash for all sorts of assorted things. I'm sure you'll find there's some radio astronomers getting money from there. There was, of course, the Air Force Office of Scientific Research, but there was also the Air Force Cambridge Research Labs.
Right.
Now, you could also get money from Sacramento Peak,
right,
which got its money from AFCRL, but nevertheless,
it
was a quite different procedure. Now, if I had to scratch my head, and there was the Research Corporation, I got money from them myself. So did REBA.
REBA still does.
You know, so now we're up to at least six or seven now, yeah. And I'm sure there were 12 or 15,
yeah,
if you went and counted them.
In 1962 was published your review article on radio astronomy techniques in the Handbuch.
Oh, yes. That was my best-selling reprint. I blackmailed those chaps. They were 3 years late printing that. They got my article on the deadline, and then they waited for another several years until all the other articles came in. So I blackmailed them. And the result was I got 500 free reprints. Now it's a thick reprint. It's a book.
Do you still have any?
Do I still have any?
Yes.
Well, I may have one.
I'd love to have one if you had a spare.
Each year from Manchester, I would get applications, individual handwritten letters, from about 15 research students who wanted one.
Right.
And I sent these. I've sent them everywhere.
Right.
And,
but I wanted to ask you, it brings up the question of techniques in radio astronomy, yes, and so forth, and another theme that I'd like to look into in my overall study is the relationship between the technology and the science. How do you see that relationship? Do you think that it's in sort of a willy-nilly thing, whatever could be done, did get done?
No, I've got a quite systematic view on that, which is shared by lots of people. For instance, there was a committee which Jesse Greenstein chaired that brought out a report on astronomy, and in that, it points out that there are two ways of going about astronomical research.
This is the 1970 committee?
Greenstein
committee, right. Okay.
I'm just thinking of the National Academy of Sciences newsletter. I'm thinking about their buff-colored 4 or 6 page newsletter that comes out every now and again, and I remember it had an excerpt from the Greenstein report.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Reproducing this material, I'm now going to have to paraphrase for you. There are two things you can do. One is to sit down and theorize about what might be there, and then design an observation a crucial experiment, perhaps.
Right.
To decide if it's this, if that's the case or not. The other thing you can do is look at what phase space has been explored by instruments, what bandwidths, what frequency coverage, what wavelength, whatever. And then imagine an instrument which would explore things which would not have been observed by the existing instruments. So you build that instrument, and in the expectation that you will discover something. Now there are two different modes of going about it. Now there are people who do not know about the other mode, and you discover these, the existence of these people, in reviews of your proposals that you get back from NSF. Or someone will say, this man hasn't said what he's going to discover. No. Then so you realize there are people who are unaware of and certainly don't subscribe to this other way of doing it. Now the Greenstein report says that 90% of all discoveries in astronomy have been made by building the new instrument, regardless or in the absence of an idea of what you're going to discover. Now that is astounding news to a lot of people. I believe it because I've seen all through my life, both in ionospheric work and radio astronomy and in some other things that I've had experience with, that's been inevitably the case. You push the instrument beyond what you had before, and nature will provide you with occupancy of that new space that you're observing. If you expand your instrument to observe polarization, you will discover polarization. It will be a discovery because it was not measurable with the instrument that did not have polarization.
So you have a philosophy that nature will take up all these degrees of freedom that are possible, in essence.
Well, I'm persuaded to that by experience.
Right.
I've applied this once or twice. When the 3K radiation was discovered, it was reported as isotropic. Well, of course, it was 3 plus or minus 1 degrees. I said to myself, either this is going to be a new branch of science or not. If it proves to be perfectly isotropic, then there's only one number to measure, and when that's been measured, and of course as a function of frequency, that will be the end. If it's to be a new branch of science, then there will be structure to be observed on the sky. So I began to imagine what this structure might be. I thought you might see a lacy network, you might see cracks between the parts of the universe as it broke up, or you might find there were three great lumps. No one would ever do the theory of a universe that broke up into three lumps. They will do the universe, the theory of an isotropic universe, or they will do the theory of a universe with homogeneous turbulence, that's to say with an infinite number of things, something that's Gaussian, that sounds like good theory, or they might do something with a dipole or a quadrupole moment. But if the universe broke up into something like a pyramid with four points, no one would ever do the theory of that. That is the sort of thing one discovers. And if you were to look at the sky and find there were three great big lumps there with cracks running between them, everyone would say, great, then they'd do the correct theory.
And say, we should have known it all along.
All right. So I said, let's have a go at this. So we did two things. I had one 60-foot dish, and I thought of a very ingenious instrument that could be put at the focus and look for variations from the 3 degrees. So we did that. Ned Conklin had just joined me as a young student, and he did the observations, and he hated to do it because for the first few weeks he couldn't see anything, and I kept telling him, Ned, this got too much thermal instability here. So we'd bring all the equipment inside and we'd turn lamps on at hourly intervals during the night. We'd turn the lamp on for an hour, then turn it off. Then we'd look at the record to see if this modulation got through. So gradually this instrument became more and more stable, but still we didn't see anything. So it was a null experiment. Well, some of the best experiments are null experiments. The outcome of that was that we were able to show at 3 millidegrees, 3 millikelvins. Now, I had never heard of a millikelvin. 3 millikelvins was the biggest that the departure could be from isotropy in the strip of sky that we observed. And for some years, nobody could beat that. And it hasn't been beaten by much now. But it's been quite impressive how much it fed into cosmology.
Yeah.
All sorts of people use it. Next thing we did was to say, well, that was too bad. We didn't find all these cracks and things. That was too bad. But let's have a look for the absolute velocity of the Earth through the cosmic sea of photons.
Right.
And we were first to find what is now known as the Great Cosine in the Sky, with an amplitude of about 3 mK, about the same as before, well, about a part in a thousand.
Within 300 kilometers a second.
About. And
with what kind of reliability?
Well, we don't know what the plus or minus would be on that. It's probably 20% or so, you see. But we do know now because it's been confirmed. Now, the history of that's kind of interesting. That was done about 1968, I suppose, more than 10 years ago. And the outcome was that we measured the velocity component parallel to the Earth's equator. We did not measure the component parallel to the Earth's axis because we used the rotation of the Earth to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the instrument was very clever. It consists of a pair of electromagnetic horns inclined about 45 degrees to the vertical, comparing what's happening in the east with what's happening in the west. And then at intervals of a few minutes, we interchange the two horns. Now, the horns are made as identical as possible. The T-junction between them is made absolutely symmetrical and tested and reversed and all sorts of things done to it. And then on top of that, we just rotate the whole setup.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that proved to be a very clever thing to do and revealed this sinusoid. It also revealed a bump where the galaxy went overhead. And so, for that reason, but really more for another reason, I wasn't sure that this result was right. The other reason is, suppose there's a gradient of temperature in the atmosphere. Suppose when you look toward the east, it's hotter than when you look toward the west, which it might well be. We're on top of a mountain 14,000 feet, but nevertheless, there's a sea in one direction and the continent in the other direction. Now, suppose there's 3 millidegrees resulting from that. Oh, boy, you see. Yeah. You'd have to repeat this on the other coast. So we didn't advertise that much. That was duly published in Nature, and Ned Conklin reported on it at an IAU symposium in Stockholm, and that was duly written up, and of course it's available in his thesis. But we did not go around shrieking that we had discovered the absolute velocity of the Earth. However, about 7 or 8 years later, with vastly improved instrumentation, Berkeley using U2s and Princeton using balloons repeated this. And in right ascension and in velocity, they bracket us. Our result agreed better with Princeton than Berkeley agreed with Princeton. And we agreed better with Berkeley than Princeton agreed with Berkeley.
Yeah.
Neither of those chaps, they're about 2 standard deviations apart, and we agree within 1 standard deviation with both of them. So I'm convinced now that that was the first detection and a reasonably accurate measurement of the absolute velocity of the Earth. Whether it's with respect to what, I don't know, but
you,
there it is.
But you bring this up as an example of just do it and see, what,
absolutely
see
right.
what's out there.
And something there.
One final thing is I'd like to hear your version briefly of the famous polarization of Centaurus A on the 210-foot story.
Oh, well, we had been observing...
Who's we now?
Now, who would we be? There's a paper written by the authors of which are Cutterback, Little, and Bracewell. That's David Cutterback, now at Berkeley, Little, you know. We wrote a paper based on observations with the east-west arm of the solar cross at Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And we measured the separation of the components of Centaurus A at 5 minutes of arc, and that would be a precision measurement, about 5.0.
Right.
It was a precise value, and we also knew that those two components were of different widths, a couple of minutes of arc in one case, and a 1 minute of arc, I forget the decimals in the other case, but distinctly different, and of distinctly different central intensities, not so very different in flux density. So that was very hard information. We knew which one was which. Now, I had that information with me when I went to Parkes, and the resolving power of the Parkes dish with the receiver that was then available at 10 centimeters was about 5 minutes of arc. The beam width, we'd have to check this, about five minutes.
No, that's right.
So at first sight, it doesn't sound as though you can do this. See, you've got two things, 5 minutes apart. But we also knew from looking at the picture of Centaurus A that these components were not likely to be on an east-west line, but were going to be either up and down on this diagonal or on the other diagonal. Didn't know which, but from the symmetry of the gadget, you could see it would be surely one or the other.
Right.
So I knew there was going to be some diagonal thing here. Trouble was the way the dish was set up. If you did ordinary TV type scans, they were not compatible. You'd do one scan, the next scan had a zero error that was not right. So as soon as I found that, I said, well, what we'll do is this. We'll do an unusual thing. We will scan diagonally. We will get both drive motors going together, and we will scan up the diagonals. So we will go through one source and then through the other on the same scan. So we won't have that loss of time where all this happens, you see. Now, the facility for rotating the horn had just been installed, and I was, as you will have heard, I was the first person to make good use of that ability which the instrument had. However, I was a bona fide guest observer, so, and the facility was there, so I wanted to turn this knob. So I took laborious scans on three nights, doing this work entirely on my own. All this observation was done with only myself and the man who drove the telescope that wouldn't let you touch it there, and Tom Cousins, who was down on the next floor controlling the receiver, which was still a bit sensitive. He had built it, but he made sure the gain stayed constant, and watching a monitoring meter and so on. So I scanned up this thing and did these diagonal scans, and because of hysteresis in the drive, I had to scan horizontally, turn on the north-south drive, it would go up this way, turn the north-south drive off and go that way, then back up, and having determined what the hysteresis would do, I did staggered diagonal scans like that. A very unusual thing, never been done since. But it was just what was needed to go through these two components in quick succession and see what was happening to the polarization. So immediately I've got 15% polarization. Now that was staggering, because for years I'd been watching what Connie Mayer did, measuring 1% polarization in this and 0.5% polarization in that. And polarization had become a very tedious thing, which one didn't want to launch into lightly.
Right.
And all of a sudden, we discover that if you've got the resolving power, you've got the polarization. It revolutionized polarization. So that's the story of what happened.
Anything else that you feel should be covered up through 62 or...
That's the whole story of my life.
The whole story of your life. Thank you very much.
That ends the interview with Ron Bracewell on 8 January 1980.